So good morning. My name is Mike Niehaus, and this session is about Windows 10 deployment. This is a repeat session, so for those of you who may have attended Jason and Christina's session on Tuesday talking about deployment, unfortunately the original version of this was offered at exactly the same time, so hopefully you're now catching up on that. There will be a little bit of overlap between what I'm talking about and what they were talking about, but what we really wanted to cover in this session is kind of give you the broader overview of what we're looking at for Windows 10 deployment. And we've kind of gone into this with this idea that we want to transition deployment from the kind of the traditional wipe and load types of deployments to instead leverage in-place upgrades. That's the idea, that we can make this process simpler by trying to use in-place upgrades to do large-scale Windows deployments. In the past, we've done this primarily for consumers. We did get some into the enterprise space with the Windows 8 to Windows 8.1 upgrades, but it's not something that enterprises have generally been doing. I mean, if you go back far enough, sure, you've probably, if you've been around that long, you've probably done in-place upgrades in the far past. I remember doing them from Windows 3.1 to Windows 95, from Windows NT 4.0 to Windows 2000, from 2000 to XP, those types of things. And after every time of doing that, I swore to myself I would never do them again because the process was always challenging. But we've made lots of changes to that in-place upgrade process since then. It used to be kind of a file-by-file replacement of the OS bits. Remove one file from the OS, drop in a new file. Remove another file, drop in a new file. It was kind of like doing surgery by just removing a little bitty piece of a tumor at a time and then dropping in the replacement parts bit by bit as well. Now with Windows 10, and really with the upgrade process that was implemented in Windows Vista and above, the technology is much more about just extracting the apps, the data, the settings, laying down a brand new clean operating system image, and then putting the apps and data back. In fact, now we've optimized that process so it's not really even moving the apps and data out of the way. It can just leave all that stuff in place and lay the new operating system over the top of it. So it's much more efficient than it used to be, much more reliable than it used to be, much faster than it used to be. I know when we went through the discussions around Windows Vista upgrades, we used to make fun of it because there was a message that came up that said this might take a long time. And long time with Windows Vista basically meant it could take upwards of 12 hours to upgrade a machine from Windows XP to Windows Vista. No one wants to wait 12 hours for a machine to upgrade because you can do the traditional wipe and load process probably in one on that exact same hardware, running the USMT to capture the user state, putting the new image down, restoring the user state, reinstalling the applications. All of that could be done much faster than an in-place upgrade. Since then, we've implemented a variety of new enhancements to the process to do things at the folder level instead of the file level, to use hard links just like we do with USMT. It's just a much faster process overall. So we hope that that's the primary mechanism that most people use, but we know that that won't be the only mechanism, so it's still viable to do the traditional in-place upgrade process if you prefer. We know that we can also do additional work around compatibility, and we'll look at a little bit of the tooling that we're working on there, but we're also looking to add a new runtime configuration option as well, so that we can provision especially new devices without having to immediately re-image them. It's probably something you do today. You buy a brand new PC, you unbox it, the first thing you do is you lay the corporate image over whatever it shipped with. Well, that's costly, and that gets in the way of some deployment scenarios like choose your own device scenarios where you allow your employees to buy anything they want PC-wise and then turn that into an enterprise device. That's generally impossible with traditional deployment methodologies because you need different drivers, different supporting hardware-based apps for every single machine. And trying to support 1,000 different models of machines in an organization that has 1,000 PCs is an IT person's worst nightmare. And today you probably try to consolidate down to a minimum number of models so that you only had to worry about the drivers for those models. When you get into these choose your own device scenarios, all of that starts to crumble. So we know that there's a lot of stuff that we can do to make sure that we make adoption of Windows 10 easier. The first thing is fairly obvious. Don't break things. We need to make sure that applications just work. So we're putting a lot of emphasis in application compatibility. And really, at the same time, we're not changing a lot with the application model. The Win32 apps will continue to work as they do today. So the compatibility challenges that people experience as they move from Windows XP to Windows 7, hopefully that's the worst problems you'll ever see. As customers have moved from 7 to 8 or 7 to 8.1, that's been much better. We expect as you go from, say, Windows 7 to Windows 10, that compatibility is really good. Web pages, same challenges, not necessarily the same level of success there. We know that there's still additional work that we can do around that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into this. The other thing is that we really didn't have a whole lot of visibility into the apps that were being used in enterprise environments. So collecting a lot more data on the machines that are in use is key for us, which is really why we've opened up the preview program as broadly as we did and as early as we did. I mean, in the past, we've done tap programs, we've done those types of releases where we'd give maybe a few thousand people access to the new bits. This time, it's like a million people have signed up for the Insider program, downloaded the ISOs, and used them to upgrade existing Windows 7 machines, 8 machines, 8.1 machines. They've set up VMs, they've used it on tablets. There's an endless variety of hardware that they've used with this Windows 10 preview release. The preview release gathers a lot of information on the apps that are installed, the usage of Windows itself, and sends that back to us so that we can look at that and see what are people actually using, what challenges are they running into, what can we do better. So that's really what this preview process is about. Getting the builds out there, getting them used broadly, getting that information back so that we can continue to adjust and react to the types of issues that we see people encountering. We also know that we need to get feedback from the customers themselves. So you'll see prompts inside of the Windows 10 preview that ask for feedback. Fill out this 3-question survey. What did you think of this new feature? All of those types of prompts will be happening during the preview period so that we can get additional data that way too. We still do have the tap programs. There are tap programs with a few hundred customers going on around the world where we're working more deeply with these customers to get the broad scale deployments in advance of the final release. But we get just as much out of the preview process as well. So we're making sure that we have sufficient feedback mechanisms for that, which we'll talk about a little at the end of the session. Lastly, we know that we need to make it simple. So whatever we can do to provide additional options to simplify the overall deployment process is key. And that's really where the in-place upgrades come in. That we think that that's a much simpler approach because you don't need to create a golden image. You don't need to have your applications packaged. You don't need to have all the drivers set up. You can just run setup and tell it, please take this existing Windows 7 device and upgrade it to Windows 10. On the compatibility perspective, we know that the hardware requirements are unchanged. So if you've got a machine that runs Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1, it will run Windows 10. Now, there were some specific hardware requirements introduced in Windows 8 and Windows 8.1, specifically for 64-bit OSs running on older Pentium D type processors. They might not have the necessary CPU instruction sets to support Windows 8 or Windows 8.1. Those same machines wouldn't be able to run a 64-bit version of Windows 10. But when's the last time you've seen a machine running a Pentium D? Because they're like 10-year-old processors. If you've still got a machine around running a 64-bit version of Windows 7 on it, it's probably time to retire that device. Overall, we've looked at the inventory of devices that are out there. We think that about 99.6% of them are fully compatible with the requirements for Windows 10, which also means that they're fully compatible with Windows 8.1. So we're not changing things overall. Same disk space requirements, same CPU requirements, same memory requirements. Windows 10 will be able to fit just fine. Strong desktop app compatibility, we talked a little bit about that already. Basically, if we don't make significant changes to the Win32 subsystem for running desktop apps, we shouldn't break those desktop apps. There's always exceptions. We can never guarantee 100% compatibility of applications. As we found, developers find creative ways to break things. But we do believe that it should be in the high 90s compatibility-wise. So we expect most apps to just work. We've kind of seen that from the experiences of customers who have moved from Windows 7 to Windows 8.1, and we're seeing the same thing from our TAP customers already today. App compatibility isn't a big deal. They put the preview on their systems. They're using it. They're not having the application problems that you would have had if you were going from XP to 7. So that's a good sign. On the Windows Store side, we would expect the same thing with these modern apps, that the modern apps should just work as well. We are making changes to the WinRT subsystem that these modern apps run under, so we have to be more careful about those types of changes to make sure we don't break these modern apps that are running on Windows 8 and 8.1. But fortunately, we have a store full of them. So as developers have submitted these apps to the store, we have those applications, and we can run automated tests using those hundreds of thousands of apps that are currently in the store to make sure that if we've made a change and it's breaking things, we can figure out what that break is and fix it so that those existing applications continue to work. So that's a good story overall there. There's still the potential that maybe a line of business app that you created yourself might break, but we think that with a population sample size of a couple hundred thousand apps in the Windows Store, that those enterprise apps shouldn't be doing anything differently than the store apps, and as a result, we'll find those compatibility challenges before we've released the OS broadly. Lastly, then, Internet Explorer is an area that's been challenging for us. I mean, we've got a lot of organizations out there that have been running IE older versions for a long time. As you move to Windows 7, you probably made the jump to at least IE 8, but a lot of you haven't made the jump beyond that because you have these internal applications, these internal web pages that just work with the older versions of IE. So we introduced one new feature in Windows 8.1, Enterprise Mode IE, to enable you to run modern web applications in IE 11 using native HTML5 support, but then to run older apps in an IE8 engine. So as a result, via policy, you can configure this set of websites goes to IE11, this set of websites goes to the IE8 engine. That provides new options, so we hope that most customers will make the migration to IE11 and use Enterprise Mode IE to make that easier. So you get the performance benefits, the new capabilities from IE11, but you also get compatibility for your apps. We're going to continue to invest in that. I know that there was a session earlier this week where we talked about some things that we're doing very soon, even on Windows 7 and 8.1, to enhance enterprise mode even more. So we'll provide capabilities to override the document types on specific web pages to say, this web page might say that it supports IE 11 or Edge mode, but in reality, it has problems with that. Let's force that into IE 8 mode as well. So we get those types of controls added too. Hopefully, we won't stop there. We've got some ideas on some additional things that we can do to make the web app compatibility problem better. But what we would suggest in the near term is even if you're not looking to go to Windows 10 right away, you should be looking at IE 11 on Windows 7. Using these enterprise mode capabilities to try to take care of more of that web app problem now so that in the future when you are looking to make an OS migration, you've already solved that particular issue. So what we're looking at from a kind of a reporting perspective for organizations is in the past we've had the application compatibility toolkit. And the application compatibility toolkit had a collector that you had to push out to your machines. It would gather inventory. It would send that back to the AppCompat database. It would store that. And then you could combine that with your Config Manager inventory and run reports with these two different databases, talking to our cloud service that would give you compatibility details on the apps that had been reported by the ISV, by the end users, by the companies that are using those apps. That was rather inconvenient because most of you would say, well, I've already got Config Manager. It's already inventorying my organization. Why do I have to run another inventory tool in order to gather this detail about what's on the machines? So what we're looking to do for Windows 10 is add some new WMI capabilities to expose that same type of inventory directly to Config Manager. To do that, we'll use WMI. So we'll create additional WMI classes. Those WMI classes allow Config Manager inventory to just grab this stuff directly. That way you don't need two databases, you can get it down to just one. And we'll have the necessary links then between the data that's being gathered here and the compatibility information that's off in the cloud. So that makes reporting much easier. So the types of things that we can do are to look at the installed software, which I can't seem to type, using Win32 installed program, which is a new class that's present in the current preview builds. We can then display some useful information like the name, the version, the architecture, and whether it's a modern app. I'll go ahead and sort these descending because I want to see the more interesting ones at top. And I'll output that as a grid view just so I can see it easily. So still a work in progress. The classes are there. All of the details for those are still being added, but you can see the type of information that we're actually looking to grab on the applications themselves, the versions, the architectures. And what we'll continue to add to that would be the identifiers that would allow you to connect back into the web databases to look at compatibility information. We also will have similar information for drivers. So we can get the WMI instances for Win32 device containers, where we can select manufacturer, model name, friendly name, and put that into a grid as well. And see the driver information that's on the system. Same basic idea that we should be able to inventory all of the extra out-of-box drivers, the ones that aren't part of Windows. Now, this is a virtual machine, so you don't see much of interest here because the extra stuff that's being added in is mostly the things being added by Office, but we would continue to expand that to get the information on all the out-of-box drivers so that you can check the compatibility of those as well. So that's kind of the building block, that we can put that data into the operating system, and we can then enable that to be collected using Config Manager, where you can then report against it. The challenge with that approach, so let's assume that we've added this into Windows 10. What good does it do you to inventory this on Windows 10 in order to figure out, will this system run Windows 10? You really want this inventory all the way back to Windows 7. So we have to update Windows 7, Windows 8, and Windows 8.1 to add these same WMI classes. That's the plan. So we'll update WMI to add these additional inventory classes, even on Windows 7, 8, and 8.1. So that's a good thing. That means that we have inventory that we can gather without extra tools. So it is available today in Windows 10. It will be in earlier Windows versions. You can collect it using Config Manager. Since it has extensible inventory capabilities and can really grab any WMI information that's on the system, Win32 installed program is the main program or the main class that we were looking at, along with the Win32 device container. But there are more of those. There's Win32 installed program usage, which actually shows you most used to least used applications. Basically, Windows is keeping track of which apps are actually used and which ones aren't. So you can inventory that. It has information about the files for the programs. It even will gather information on the frameworks being used by those programs. Is this a .NET 2 application? Is it a .NET 4 application? It'll be able to tell you about the frameworks that are being used by those apps. On the device side, there are a couple of related classes as well, the installed device and the installed device hardware ID, that gives you more of the details on those drivers rather than more of the logical information that we were looking at before. So this is all still a work in progress. You'll see the classes there in the current builds. You can play with them, but there's still additional work to be done. It'll continue to evolve as the new preview builds come out. So don't expect it to be 100% useful information at this point, but we will get there by RTM to make sure that we can expose all of this data for your inventory tools. So let's dig in then to the deployment choices. We talked a little bit about this already. We've always had these wipe and load processes. The traditional process where you capture the data in settings, move it off to the side, deploy a new, typically custom OS image to the machine, and then put everything back. Inject the drivers, install the apps, restore the data in settings. That's not going away, it's still there. We're going to update all the tools to support that. But the in-place upgrade is where we want to focus on to let Windows do more of the work. With this, you still preserve everything. If you're coming from Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1, we'll preserve all the data, all the settings, all the apps, all the drivers. So no extra work required there. We just run setup.exe with the necessary switches, telling it automate this upgrade process. If you've ever tried this in the past, there was this concept of full upgrades versus data-only upgrades versus nothing upgrades. And behind the scenes, I mean, all of those still exist, but you'll be able to migrate everything from Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1. So data-only would be more of a choice because you wanted to get rid of the apps and wanted to start clean but wanted all your data files. But normally, you would migrate everything. So we'll be able to do that. The biggest challenge then with this type of scenario is just how do I automate this as an enterprise? So how do I do this on a large scale? Because doing it manually by inserting the media and running the wizard to do this isn't something that you want to do broadly. It's something that I want to put inside of a task sequence. I want to push it out using more automated methods. So we'll look at those in a minute. So we would recommend this for existing devices. As long as you meet the basic requirements, there are some limitations with this. One is you must use the standard install.wim off of the media to do this in-place upgrade. You can't use a custom image because Windows really doesn't know how to merge apps that are contained in these custom images. Imagine your custom image contains Windows 10 and Office 2013, and you're upgrading a Windows 7 system that contains Office 2007. How does it know how to deal with that when it tries to merge those applications together? Will either of them work after you do that? Who knows? So as a result, we're saying we need to start with a clean image. That clean image can be fully patched, but it can't contain any apps. Because if it contained any apps, well, then the results are unpredictable. So at this point, we would say use the standard install.wim and use that for the in-place upgrade. The third scenario we touched on a little bit already for provisioning is really targeting new devices. For enterprises, at least, it's how do I take a new device out of the box and not immediately re-image it? You can still do that if you want. I mean, that's a fine practice if you want to do that. But for these choose-your-own-device scenarios where every model could be different, every PC could be different, you really want the ability to do this. We've had organizations come to us saying that they want to implement a choose-your-own-device solution, and this is our answer to provide additional tooling to do that. We don't expect that to be used for every organization. We would expect most organizations are going to stick with Config Manager, MDT, their existing deployment tools, even if you do the in-place upgrades. So this is really just for those organizations that are looking at these new scenarios. The tooling for these provisioning scenarios does actually support image deployment as well, using the USB USB sticks, hard drives, network, lots of different scenarios for that. But that's really targeting more of the system builder, OEM, and ODM spaces, not the traditional enterprise space. So don't confuse this with a new tool that's designed to replace MDT or Config Manager. That's not the intent. It's really to provide these for other new scenarios and for these other types of usages for OEMs and system builders, rather than something that you would replace an existing tool with. That's not to say you couldn't use this. You could create a provisioning package using these tools and then put it as part of a task sequence and use it to do additional configuration on the OS. That'll be possible, so you can leverage the two together, but this isn't designed to replace any of your existing tooling. So let's talk more about the in-place upgrade process. If you're coming from Windows 7 or Windows 8, the idea is that this is the traditional automated in-place upgrade. You can use System Center and MDT to automate that process, but it actually gets simpler if you're coming from Windows 8.1. In the case of Windows 8.1, it's a servicing operation. If you've installed the Windows 8.1 update, which was like an 800 meg patch that got installed over the top of an existing Windows 8.1 installation, install it, reboot. Same basic idea here, that if you're running Windows 8.1, you can install a big patch, reboot the system, now it's running Windows 10. So going from 8.1 to 10 is the easiest and fastest. Going from 7 or 8 to Windows 10 is an in-place upgrade that will take a little while longer, but still achieves the same thing: automatically preserving apps, data, settings, using the standard Windows 10 image to do this. It's designed to be fast, but more importantly, it's designed to be reliable. We need to make sure that if anything ever goes wrong, the system rolls back. And it's amazing the types of things that can go wrong. I've experienced that myself here this week, where I was upgrading to a new build while sitting in the front row of a session without any power, thinking that, oh, I've got 50% battery, that should be enough to complete this process. Well, guess what? It wasn't. So the upgrade process got about 75% of the way through. It was applying settings to the new operating system, and the system went dead. Normally, you would think that would result in a bricked system, that I'd have no hope of recovering from that scenario. But as soon as the session was over, I went to a room, I plugged the machine into power again, I turned it back on, it came up, and it said, rolling back to your previous operating system. It knew something went wrong. It had no idea what went wrong. The fact that the battery died was unknown to the upgrade process, but it said, I'm not taking any chances with the state of this machine. I'm going to roll it back to what it was running before. So it rolled back. It took about 15 minutes. I logged back in. I could get to my email. I could be productive. And then after my battery charged again, I could kick off the upgrade process again and take my chances again, sitting in a session room doing an in-place upgrade with no power. So making sure that it's reliable is key. We don't care what the failure is. If it's a blue screen because of a bad driver, if it's losing the power, if it's someone holding down the power button, whatever the scenario is where we run into problems, we need to make sure that this rollback process is bulletproof. Our testers routinely do exactly those types of scenarios. Let's wait until this exact moment and hit the power button. Let's let it go a little bit farther, hit the power button. Let's throw in bad drivers, forcing the system to blue screen just to see what happens. So we can run through all of these scenarios just to make sure the rollback is successful. If you were in Jason and Christina's session where they talked about this, it's the same basic process we used internally to go from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1, and we measured the results. First, we had like a 97% success rate upgrading from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1 using this automated setup. But more importantly, for those 3% of failures, they all just rolled back to the previous OS. So as a result, they only got about half the number of help desk calls from people saying something went wrong. They just noticed that, oh, I'm back in the old OS again. They just went back to work. IT can then look at the logs, they can figure out what happened, they can then push it out again to the same machine after taking any remediation steps that are required, and odds are the next time it's going to go through okay. Maybe it's they didn't have enough disk space, maybe it was incompatibility with a particular application or driver. Doesn't matter what it is, we need to make sure that we never brick a system. So very important for us to test out all those scenarios, make sure that that just works. We have had quite a few customers that have come to us and asked specifically for that. It was popular to go from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1 for those few customers that actually deployed Windows 8 broadly. The interesting one was the customers that came to us and said, we want to do this to go from Windows 7 to Windows 8.1. So we have worked with some customers to enable that, just so that we could gather more information about, well, what could go wrong? What complications could we run into? What do we need to do to make this process better? And we've been using the results from that to put design changes into the setup process. We'll look at some of those in a minute, like adding additional command line switches to let you override the behavior of setup by default, not requiring that you inject additional files into your image just so that the process can run a script when the OS comes back up. We can do more in setup itself to make this easier. We also encountered some challenges around third-party disk encryption software. If you've got BitLocker on a system, Windows knows how to suspend BitLocker to do the in-place upgrade. But if you've got a third-party tool, Windows has no idea what to do with that. So we have to block it. If we see a third-party disk encryption tool on the system, we'll block the execution of the upgrade process, which means that you have to either fall back to the wipe and load process and try to integrate something into that to deal with the encrypted disk yourself, or you have to decrypt the disks, do the upgrade, and then re-encrypt them. Neither of those options is particularly good. So we've started working with the ISVs for those software packages to figure out what can we do and what can they do working together to integrate their software into this in-place upgrade process to make this just work. We're not there yet. We're still making progress with these ISVs to really figure out how to do this best, but that is one of the challenges that you'll run into with the preview. So if you are running third-party disk encryption, you will get blocked by the upgrade process. One of the other challenges is 32-bit to 64-bit. We can't do architecture changes. It's also challenging if you wanted to go from a system running with legacy BIOS emulation and you wanted to switch over to native UEFI, doing an in-place upgrade, you can't do that. You would have to leave the system in whatever BIOS or firmware mode you had it in for the existing OS after the upgrade process completes. So we can't solve those problems. In those scenarios, you still need to use the traditional deployment mechanisms. But if you're going from 64 to 64, 32 to 32, UEFI to UEFI, legacy BIOS to legacy BIOS, all those scenarios are fine. So let's look a little bit more at the in-place upgrade process. Starting from more of the basic consumer perspectives. So let me bring up a Windows 7 system. Slowly, as the network catches up. So you can go to the website for the Insider program, which is preview.windows.com, and I can't type. Of course, someone's squatting on that domain. preview.windows.com. And sign up as an insider. Basically, insider gives you access to the builds and also allows you to submit feedback on the preview process. I can say that I want to sign in. And since I'm already registered, it should just tell me, all right, what do you want to do from here? Now, it knows that I am on a Windows 7 system. So it'll suggest that I do the actual installation process using Windows Update. It says you're already registered. Do you want to install it? Yes, I do. Start the upgrade now. So this downloads an executable. This executable is basically going to install an OS update. This OS update enables Windows Update to initiate the upgrade process. Apparently I didn't click on it right. That executable installs the update for the Windows Update client, says, okay, now you need to reboot the computer. After you've rebooted the computer, now Windows Update can pop up and show you that there's a preview build available. So there's the pop-up, Windows Technical Preview.exe, which just has a few pieces in it. It installs the security update, or not security update, the Windows Update client update. It then prompts you to say reboot the computer, and after it comes back up, it launches the Windows Update control panel. So I've already done that just to save some time and left the system here with the, at least I thought I already did that. So we'll let it check. Hopefully it will see the Windows update process. Okay, we'll come back to that one in a minute. That check takes too long. Let's move on to machine number two, which is a configuration manager client. The configuration manager client is set up to run a task sequence. This task sequence contains the steps necessary to initiate the upgrade. So all we need to do here is say that we want to execute this task sequence, which I've done before just to make sure that it would work, so it's telling me I want to retry it. We'll kick off the install. It will download all the pieces necessary for that and then kick off the task sequence. Now, this is a completely automated process. It's going to run through some PowerShell scripts to get the Config Manager client prepared for the idea that the old OS is going to be ripped out from underneath it and a new OS is going to be put in place. It then runs setup.exe with the necessary command line switches to automate the whole process. And then after the new OS is up and running, it puts the Config Manager client back into a proper state on the new OS. So all that's automated. There was a blog that was posted by Aaron, the PM for OSD, earlier this week that gives you this exact same task sequence. You can download that from the Config Manager team blog, import it into your Config Manager environment, adding in the Windows 10 preview bits into the package for that so you don't have to download the whole set there, and then you can try this out yourself. It's a fairly easy process to go through. If we keep watching this for the next hour or so, it will fully upgrade this virtual machine from Windows 7 to Windows 10 preview version. Not to be left out, we can do exactly the same thing with MDT. So I've got another virtual machine here running Windows 7. And I can go to, man, I really can't type today, Contoso Management Deployment Share Scripts LightTouch.vbs. And we can initiate an MDT task sequence that does exactly the same thing. So the wizard will come up. We can choose that task sequence. We can initiate the process. Now, in the MDT case, there's no Config Manager client to worry about, so we don't need to do any PowerShell scripting or anything like that. We just need to initiate the automated upgrade command. So it almost immediately gets into that step where it's upgrading Windows. We're specifying that that upgrade is completely quiet, so you never actually see the upgrade user experience show up on screen. All you see is the task sequence progress dialog to show you that this is going on. Let me see what that first machine looks like now. All right, so now this is the first machine, the one that we installed the executable on and rebooted. It's now showing the technical preview is available through Windows Update. We can just go ahead and click the install button and it will initiate the install for the technical preview directly from Windows Update. Imagine us expanding this scenario as well. Like you use WSUS today. Imagine just being able to go in and approve a new operating system in WSUS. That's one of the goals. We're not quite there yet, but certainly we want to make this as easy to deploy as possible using any tooling that you would choose to do that with. So let's look at these task sequences. Let's go over to my config manager / MDT server. And first look at this from a config manager perspective. Yeah, I hate that. I have virtual machines. I really don't need them to lock. They're on a private network sitting in my office. So we have the task sequence here. I can edit it just to show you the steps that are involved. It's not a long task sequence. We've got a simple readiness check just to make sure it meets the requirements for the OS, but since it's already running Windows 7 or above, that shouldn't be a problem. The pre-setup runs a PowerShell script that puts the client in the proper state before the OS is upgraded out from under it. We need to copy some scripts locally to the system so that setup can find them. Setup will call one script if the installation process succeeds, another script if the installation process fails. So this actually copies both of those scripts and anything that they reference into a folder on the hard drive. Then we can initiate the upgrade, which just runs setup.exe, specifying that we want to automatically upgrade, that we want to do this quietly, so with no user interaction at all, not even a progress dialogue. And we don't want the system to reboot because task sequences don't like reboots being initiated without it being able to control that. So we say, don't reboot the system. We'll take care of that on your behalf. Normally, the upgrade process will go out to Windows Update and download any updated compatibility information using this dynamic update process. You can disable that with a command line utility. The idea would be that for bulk enterprise deployments, you really don't want thousands of machines to all go out to Windows Update and download those pieces. Instead, you can manually update your source files with the latest compatibility database and just put that into your config manager process. As a result, we can disable dynamic update. We then specify the commands that we want to run. So post UBI is basically in the case where we successfully upgrade, and post rollback is what happens if there's any type of failure. We just point to the folder that contains the batch files that should run in either of those cases. There are some situations where setup.exe actually fails before it even starts the deployment. It sets a non-zero return code to indicate that a failure occurred. So in those cases, we can immediately run the PowerShell script to put the system back into the right state before we cause the task sequence to fail and report that back. Assuming it didn't fail, we'll restart the computer. So this is a conditional step that says only if the upgrade succeeded, let's restart the computer. After we come back up into the new OS, we can install software updates, do the final cleanup of removing that temporary folder, and then the process is done. If there's a failure and we're initiating a rollback, we can conditionally figure that out just by a step here that looks to see if there's a rollback file in the folder that we created. So the script that gets run in the case of a rollback will create a file that we can look for. And that just does the necessary cleanup after the fact. So there's not a whole lot to the task sequence, but you can imagine maybe you needed to do some additional configuration as part of that. Maybe there are some things you wanted to remove before the task sequence starts. Maybe there's a new version of antivirus software or VPN clients or something else that you wanted to install after. You can put all of that into this task sequence to automate the whole process. In the case of MDT, actually one more thing before we switch to MDT. The batch files and the scripts, which are part of Aaron's download package, have a particular name, because we didn't specify the name of the file. We just said, here's the folder that you can find it in. So if we go to my folder here, where I imported the task sequence from, the scripts are all here. So the one that runs in the case of success is setup complete.cmd, which just does a variety of things for logging, and then after it's set all that up, it calls setup complete.ps1, which is a PowerShell script, which does all the client configuration stuff. Setup rollback is the one that runs in the case of a failure. Same basic setup. Let's do some logging and then call a PowerShell script to do whatever's necessary in that case. So all of those are provided as part of the download. You can try that out. Now let's talk about MDT. In the case of MDT, same basic task sequence structure, where we can check for readiness, make sure the machine meets the requirements. We can copy the batch files that we need, which we placed into the MDT deployment chair, copy them to the local system. Maybe you want to skip the final summary wizard if this succeeds, so that they're just left at a logon screen where they can log back into the new OS. So we've left that step commented out, but you could enable that if you wanted to skip the final wizard. We have an install operating system step here, but it's disabled. It's really just so that the task sequence knows what OS is being used for the upgrade, so that step doesn't do anything. We actually found a bug, though, when we were testing this out. We said, all right, we'll put the Windows source files in the MDT deployment chair and then just run the source path task sequence variable points to the location. So we'll run percent source path percent backslash setup.exe. Well, the path in MDT would be something like deployment chair, operating systems, Windows technical preview, setup.exe. Setup blows up if it runs into a path that has spaces in it. Gotta hate those bugs. But to work around that, we put a step into the task sequence that just maps a drive to that specific location. That way it doesn't have any spaces in the path, so it can then run the setup.exe command from that mapped drive, which is O:\, and with the same command line options that we had looked at before. Auto upgrade, quiet, no reboot, disabling dynamic update. And if we keep on scrolling, it specifies the post ubi command to point to that same folder and post rollback. Now, as I mentioned before, the MDT doesn't have a client, so there's nothing that needs to be prepared on the machine. So the batch files are simpler. We'll look at those in a minute. After that upgrade completes, we can unmap the drive since that's not needed anymore, restart the computer to continue the upgrade process, and once the new OS is up and running, we do some cleanup tasks to remove that temporary folder. In the case of rollback, the only thing we really need to do is exit with a non-zero return code so that the task sequence fails and displays the final summary dialog to say something happened, something didn't work. So there's no scripts involved in the MDT case. All there is batch files that are called automatically by setup. Those have been copied into the scripts folder here. So if we look at setup complete, which runs in the success case, it's the simplest batch file ever. Basically, it goes searching for lighttouch.wsf on every single drive, and wherever it finds it, it runs it. It passes a command line switch, OS install equals success, which basically just sets a task sequence variable to tell MDT that the OS installation was successful. You can imagine that if we look at the setup rollback, it's going to be very similar, except it says OS install fail. So it sets a task sequence variable to say the OS install failed. But otherwise, same basic process. We will look through all the drives. We'll find the lighttouch.wsf script, which is locally on the machine, and we'll run it. So didn't take us too much to figure that out, since we had already put the work into the setup.exe engine to make all of this possible based on the feedback that we got from the customers who were going from Windows 7 to 8.1. We just needed to build a task sequence structure around that. We'll try to publish this one again soon, probably through the Config Manager or MDT blogs, just to make it so that you don't need to type all this in yourself. It is much simpler than the Config Manager setup because you don't have these 100-line PowerShell scripts to worry about. You just have a very simple batch file, so I'm sure you could recreate this yourself, but we'll save you the trouble and publish a task sequence template to do it. So behind the scenes, we've looked at this. There are new command line options for setup.exe. The post-UBI and post-rollback ones we saw in that example, they enable you to specify a folder that contains the batch files. Without those switches, you'd have to inject those files into your image to put them in the Windows System 32 folder, which is where they would be, where it would look for them by default. We've added some new switches for controlling the driver operations. By default, the installation process, the upgrade process, will use the newer drivers that are in the Windows 8, in the Windows 10 image, or if there isn't one, it'll continue to use the existing driver from the current OS. You can override that, though, by specifying, I don't want to use the Windows 10 drivers, I just want to migrate all the drivers, specifying a migrate all drivers switch, or I can specify slash install drivers and point to a folder that contains new drivers that I want to use instead of the drivers that are in the Windows image. So we'll give you more control over that process. Lastly, we've added a copy log switch. The copy log switch allows you to say when setup finishes, copy the logs here. Now, I wouldn't necessarily suggest putting a network location in there because typically this is going to run in the context of the computer account. So you may have security issues trying to copy them to a network location, but you could at least put them in a location that's easier to find than $windows-bt-sources-panther-setup-act.log. You can have it copy them somewhere else. There are return codes that are being set on setup.exe. In the past, it wasn't particularly good at setting anything other than return code 0, so it now has specific return codes that mean different things. Like there'll be a return code that says there was a compatibility check that didn't pass. So you can check the return codes to see what actually happened from there. When we looked at the machine that was being upgraded from Windows Update, the downloadable executable for that was Windows Technical Preview.exe. That actually installs KBE2990214, which is the updated Windows Update client that can see the preview. If by chance someone puts that on a machine and no longer wants to see that popping up to upgrade to the preview, you can just uninstall it. So if you go to the list of installed Windows updates on the machine, search for that KB, uninstall it, reboot the machine, and now you won't see the preview anymore. All right, so let's shift gears then to provisioning. The basic idea is that we should be able to take off-the-shelf hardware, take it out of the box, plug it in, apply a provisioning package to it using a variety of mechanisms to make the device ready for productive use. These could be desktop devices. These could be mobile devices. The same solution applies for both. So you can probably imagine, even if you wouldn't want to look at this for PC scenarios, maybe you want to look at this for phone scenarios. You want to be able to get a new phone out of the box. You're not going to re-image a phone. You're going to just customize it for the organization's use. So we can take this off-the-shelf hardware. We can then have these provisioning packages either on a USB key, on an NFC tag. We can send them out via an email message. We can push them out over the network. There's a variety of deployment options for these. But basically then we run them on the device to transform it into an enterprise device. It's a variety of things that we can transform. We can install apps, we can create Wi-Fi profiles, we can create VPN connections. We can do a bunch of different things to customize the device to make it ready. Most importantly, though, we can enroll the device in a management solution so that it can continue to be managed after the provisioning process is complete. We can automatically locate these. So imagine a device, you plug it into the corporate network, you turn it on for the first time. It can search out a well-known location on your network, grab the provisioning package from that location, and install it without you needing to specify anything. It just finds that provisioning package on the network and pulls it from there. So there's some interesting scenarios for that, but really it's focused on those new device scenarios where you want to customize the device. The tooling that we use for that is built into the new ADK that will be coming out. I've got an early version of that installed on a virtual machine here, so let's take a quick look at that. It is most certainly a work in progress. It is a very ugly tool, which isn't terribly surprising for a work in progress deployment tool. The tool is called the ICD tool, Windows ICD, the Image and Configuration Designer. The basic idea is we can create a project with a name of whatever we want it to be. We could create a provisioning package, which is just a standalone piece that can be used to do the configuration. We could also create a full image with this customization applied to it. The same would be true for the mobile images as well, if you're going to be deploying phones. So we'll just stick with the simple one because that's what's most useful in enterprise cases. And we can choose what OS we want. I'll say enterprise in this case. And then we can see the available settings. So we can customize this however we want, add our own apps, add any drivers that might need to be injected, any language packs that we want to add. But most of the emphasis, at least initially, is around settings. So maybe we wanted to go in and specify that we want terminal services to be turned on. We can find the setting in question. We can say that we want to enable terminal services or remote desktop, which requires unchecking the box. Standard Microsoft backwards logic. We add that to the provisioning pack as a configured customization, and then we can build the actual package. So we just specify where we want to put it. I specify an output location. That location, the default, is as good as any. Call this one Friday. Say to build it. And now we have a provisioning package, a PPKG file. So if we look at Explorer, we'll see that file sitting there. There's an executable on the system that's registered to process any .ppkg files. So all we had to do to cause it to process this one is double click it. It will launch the utility. It will ask for confirmation. Do you really want to install this? And as long as I say OK, it'll apply that setting to the OS. So the setup itself is fairly simple. Most of the work is done on the authoring side to specify what you want to provision. The runtime pieces are relatively straightforward to just say, yep, go ahead and apply this to the machine. In this case, the setting's already applied to my machine, so I'll go ahead and cancel out of here. And even though I canceled out of here, it's going to give me an error message, but that's okay. It's a work in progress. That's the basic idea, that we can do this type of configuration. Now, the hope is that we can simplify that a lot, because while we see this as a tool for OEMs, ODMs, and system builders, we also would like this to be a tool that could work for IT generalists, maybe in schools or someplace like that, where they just want something really, really simple. MDT is not simple. Config Manager is not simple. Doing something manually with the ADK otherwise is not simple. We should be able to provide a simple option. So the hope is that we can provide almost the easy button to say, build me up a provisioning package with an image, put it on a USB key, and let me take it from machine to machine to deploy to those machines. It's not there yet. The tool as written is still only IT Pro capable, so we've got a lot of work to do there, but the hope still is that we can get into that easier space. So we've got the new tools, the Windows Imaging and Configuration Designer, ICD. Technically, it's the Windows ICD because we always want to follow our proper brand guidelines. It will be part of the assessment and deployment kit, the ADK. It's basically used to create these provisioning packages, both for desktop machines and for phones. There's a command line tool currently called provtool.exe. I'm hoping it comes up with a better name at some point, but it's part of Windows 10, even in the current preview builds. It knows how to install these provisioning packages. It can configure the running devices. Say you have a Windows device that's already up and running. It can be used to set up new ones, or it can be used to deploy new images to a brand new device. We talked about some of the capabilities around language packs, apps, updates, certs. It can do Wi-Fi, VPN, IE settings, WSS settings. It can enroll the device in management. That's what we're still trying to figure out. What's the core set of configuration capabilities that you want to be able to do so that we can make this as easy as possible? So then we shift in back into the traditional deployment realm. We know that we need to update the existing tools to fully support Windows 10, so we will have a new assessment and deployment kit that will support Windows 10. We also know that it's kind of silly if we force you to use the old ADK for deploying Windows 7 and the new ADK for deploying Windows 10. So we want to make sure that the new ADK will support OSs from Windows 7 on up. That way you can not have to worry quite so much about multiple versions of Windows PE and multiple versions of USMT and multiple versions of all these other tools that are part of the package. We know that we can do this with Config Manager 2012 and above. We want to make sure that we don't require any large-scale infrastructure upgrades to support deployment of Windows 10. So they'll update Config Manager 2012 and 2012 R2 to support using Windows PE boot images built using this new ADK. So that's nice. You don't need to upgrade Config Manager. You may need to apply a hotfix or a cumulative update that adds support for Windows 10 as a new supported platform, but that's much, much simpler than saying you must upgrade to Config Manager vNext in order to get support for deploying Windows 10. We want to make this as easy as possible. Same goes for the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. We'll update that to add support for bare metal and refresh deployments of Windows 10. The main changes that we would be looking to make then are any compatibility updates for the full support of Windows 10 and any changes that are necessary for the new ADK. So we're not planning any extensive changes to the overall deployment processes. So if you already know how to deploy Windows 7 or Windows 8.1, deploying 10 will feel natural. Same task sequences, same basic steps involved, same basic tools installed. You should just be able to download a Windows 10 ISO from the Volume License Service Center once we RTM, from the preview site once we get the updated ADK and MDT bits available, import that into Config Manager or into MDT, build your new master image, sysprep it, capture it, deploy it. Timeline-wise, it's not available yet. We didn't release an updated ADK. As a result, the Config Manager and MDT team basically said, well, we can't do anything yet. So we've held off on that. We really wanted to focus on the in-place upgrade process for the first few months of the preview process so that we could get more data and more experience on those in-place upgrades and then shift more to the traditional deployment scenarios sometime early next year, where we can make available the ADK, a preview for MDT, and potentially previews for Config Manager as well. So we'll get there, but for right now, the focus would be on in-place upgrades. We'll get to the traditional deployment tools in a few months. So that gets us back to the preview process. We're going through this preview process where we're making preview builds available to organizations through a process that we've called flighting. This flighting process enables us to push out new builds every so often. And at least initially, we're doing this on about a monthly cadence. So we had the original preview release, then we came out with a new one in the middle of October. We'll probably come out with another one in a couple of weeks. And we continue to add new features, new capabilities, new bug fixes into these preview releases. We've got this concept of rings where we will push out the updates in phases. We've got our internal rings. We've actually got a few of those. There's rings called canary rings. There are broader rings inside of Microsoft and then basically the whole company internally. After we've passed that, then we start with the Windows Insiders. And you can indicate now with the October build whether you want to be on the fast ring or the slow ring. So you could say on the fast ring, I want every single build that comes out. Or you can put yourself on a slow ring and say, I just want the big ones. So don't update me until the next big release comes out that adds significant functionality that I might want to try out. So hopefully we work out most of the issues internally before you ever see them. I know I've experienced some pain from some of those canary builds on my own laptop, which is why I was trying to upgrade my machine from the front row of a session without battery power. But most of the external releases, we should get those issues ironed out, which is what us 100,000 Microsoft guinea pigs are for. So we're rolling these out in phases, adding new functionality as it's available. The next real big push will come after the new year, where we add in new, very significant chunks of additional functionality. What you'll see between now and then is most likely going to be just incremental updates to the existing features that we've released, really setting the stage, adding the plumbing for the new capabilities that'll be coming along then. We are actively soliciting feedback. That's the big focus for the current builds, is to get people used to this idea of submitting feedback about the preview. And we've got a slew of options for doing this. In Windows 10 itself, there's a Windows Feedback app. You can run this application. You're basically logged in using your Windows Insider Microsoft account. You submit the feedback, and we're reviewing all the feedback that we get in. Hundreds of thousands of entries in the user-initiated feedback bucket. We also have system-initiated feedback. So if you're running the preview build, it'll pop up periodically and ask, what did you think of Alt-Tab? What did you think of the new start screen or start button? It asks you, click here, basically, and when you click there, it brings up nice short three-question surveys, places to put in your own comments, basically a way of kind of prompting you to provide feedback on the functionality that we've added. All of that gets put into our back-end bug database. It's all analyzed. It's reported on. We try to bucketize it to figure out where the main items that we are getting good responses on, or are we not getting good responses, where do we need to provide more work. So we're using that information to guide us to the areas that we need to focus on. We also have web-based options. There's the enterprise forums on TechNet. You can log into those and have more discussions around the Windows 10 functionality. It's not intended as a place where you submit feedback to Microsoft. It's more a question of where you can discuss it with other users of the preview. So it's much more community focused rather than Microsoft trying to solicit input through these forums. We've also added the Answers website. So the Answers website is more a Q&A based setup where you ask a question and then you get one or more answers to those questions. Some of those could come from Microsoft people, some of them could come from the community. And basically you, over time, kind of vote on which answers are best, and they tend to start floating up to the top. The latest one that we added, the brand new one, is the Windows feature suggestions through the user voice site. This is, for those of you who are familiar with the Kinect website, basically the idea is you can submit a feature suggestion and then vote on it. So you get 20 votes. You can use those 20 votes to bump up any of the items that have been submitted. The idea being that as these items bubble up toward the top of the list, because lots of people are voting for them, we can take a serious look at those and say, yeah, we can put that into Windows. The data that's collected through user voice is actually exposed externally, so people can run reports against it. We've seen some blogs who've been analyzing that data. And the types of things that are floating to the top are not necessarily things that we would have ever thought of. So the types of things that are making their way into those lists are significant enough, but not truly mainstream, the types of things that we would just say, oh yeah, we need to add additional Arabic calendar support. Like, who would have ever thought that we needed to put additional work into some of these multi-language capabilities? We thought we had taken care of those challenges a long time ago, but we're starting to see these feedback items and seeing the voting as they rise up to the top. So let's take a quick look at those. If you haven't seen those already, let me go back to my original client machine. Get PowerShell out of the way here. First item would be the Windows Feedback app, which is prominently featured on the Start menu. Network's a little sluggish. So we can click on Windows Feedback. Oh, sorry, had to switch the screen. Helps when you can see it. So to launch this, I just went to Start menu and then clicked Windows Feedback. It accesses this using my Microsoft account. I can put in whatever feedback I want, but more importantly, I can search for existing feedback items and do the typical plus one approach of saying that, yep, me too, I'm running into this same issue. So that allows us to focus on bugs that are being experienced by the largest groups of people. I think the network's being kind of slow here. Hello. Nope, it's just the app being slow. We'll give the app a moment to make that connection. While it's doing that, let's look at a few of the other options. This is the windows.uservoice.com website, so we can submit feature suggestions in a variety of different categories, like I prefer install, upgrade, and activate questions. When I select that, I can see the list of items that are available, and I can start looking through them and figuring out what I wanted to vote on. So I had 20 votes originally, now I'm down to 17 because I've applied three of them already to those items. So if we scroll down, we can see the list. Things like make it possible to make migration easier from different hard drive types and some installation options. Well, we've already talked about some of those. They're just really difficult. But maybe if we look at it, we can search for something that's a little more easily doable. Like if I search for up to date, I'm really tired of having to install an operating system and then immediately having to patch it with 6 months of updates. So we can search for something like up to date and see if there's anything in the list related to that. Let us download up-to-date ISOs when we want to reinstall Windows. Yeah, I'm all for that. So we can vote that one up just by saying that I want to vote. Apparently I scrolled the screen because it's so slow. So I can say that I want to vote and then choose how many votes I want to add. I can add up to three votes on one item, so it's saying that I have 20 votes left. That's because I already used three on this particular item, but I can't add any more, but certainly that's a significant item for me. Now, you probably have a different significant item, so you would choose to distribute your votes differently, but you get these options. User cannot, signed or not authorized. Yeah, whatever. I think that's the error message that says, oh, you already voted on this item, but not a very useful error message there. But that's the idea, that you can submit ideas. These are basically DCR requests. Here are the types of things that I would want to have in Windows, and then hope that people find them and agree with you and start pushing them up the list. The TechNet forums for Windows 10 are pretty much exactly what you would expect. We have these threaded conversations where you can talk about different capabilities there. Some of you like those, some of you don't. Personally, I'm not a big fan of those, but they are available. Same thing with the answer site. The answer site's much more Q&A based, where you submit a question and you see the number of answers that are pushed back through. So that one's a bit more useful for when you're trying to figure out how to do something, that site can help you there. The feedback app, which hopefully has loaded, I'm not 100% sure it's going to, or that I can even get down there to click on it. Yeah, so we'll skip that one. I'd run it from my laptop itself, but we talk about problems in Canary builds. Well, guess what? Modern apps aren't running on my current Canary build of Windows, so I can't even run it there. But the basic idea with the app is that we can see the items that have been submitted. We can type in search terms. It's not the prettiest app in the world. It's a fairly basic one, but we'll continue to provide additional tools to the insiders to allow them to interact better with us to make that easier. So certainly the goal overall is to get feedback from these insiders. So we would encourage everyone to become an insider. You can register at insider.windows.com. Once you do that, you can download the media for either Pro or Enterprise. Now, if you go to the insider.windows.com site, that will offer you the Pro SKU, and you can download that. If you want the Enterprise SKU, go to the Windows Enterprise site and click on the preview link there, and that will take you to the ISO for Enterprise. Try out the upgrade process, see how that works. Find a sacrificial Windows 7 machine, even if you had to build one. Put as many apps as you want on it. Install whatever crap you can find, and then try to upgrade it to Windows 10 and see how that process works. Keep installing the new flights as they come out. We'll come out with them probably about once a month initially. Eventually, we'll get the flighting process so that it's more update-based rather than a full upgrade process, and certainly submit feedback. So that's really what I wanted to go through, and I am about a minute over time, so we'll wrap it up there. If there are additional questions around the Windows 10 deployment process or upgrades, I'll hang around up front as long as the questions continue, but thanks for attending. Hopefully that was useful.